Welcome, everyone, to the Circle of Insight. I'm your host, Dr. Carlos, where we look at everything in psychology and try to understand human behavior. Today, our guest is Louis Ferrante. He's a former New York mobster. While he was in prison, he wrote a memoir about criminal life and the horrors of prison. He also wrote a business book that doubles as a self-help guide. In addition to his books, which have been translated into 16 languages, he has TV shows that have been dubbed in countless languages and aired all over the world. So we're going to find out more about Louis Ferrante and his psychology and the psychology of a mobster right now. Well, folks, welcome again to Circle of Insight. Let's not waste any more time. Let's welcome to the show, Louis Ferrante. How are you, sir?
Hey, very good. Thank you. How are you, Dr. Carlos?
Doing great. Thank you so much for being here. We truly appreciate it. I have to admit, I love your shows. I've watched all of the ones on the prison. Great stuff.
Great. Thank you. I'm glad you like them. I think they came a lot better than we expected them to come, because of the access we were able to get, which we didn't always, we weren't always relying on getting the best access. We thought we'd have to sort of produce as much of the show as we could if we had to, and we ended up getting tremendous access into those maximum security prisons. So I think that's what made it really good. We got to interview great, amazing, monumental figures in the underworld. And I think that's what helped make it as good as it was. Thank you.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Folks, he's also got some great books on Amazon.com. I highly recommend them, and we'll go over those again in a little bit later. His name is Louis. Last name is Ferrante, F-E-R-R-A-N-T-E. Lou, let's start off with your background a little bit. You grew up in Queens, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Queens, New York. I was there from when I was born until the day the FBI handcuffed me and took me away.
Now, you talk about being a teenager and you didn't really like school. You actually compared it to prison, and there's an irony in that story. Did you drop out of high school or did you stay in?
I didn't. So I finished high school, and I'll tell you why. I hated school, and I did it just enough to get by. I cheated my way through. In junior high, there was a girl, Angela, who used to do my homework for me. In high school, I had a couple of guys who helped me. They would always bring, a copy for me in the morning. My friend Jorge Avila used to help me cheat. He sat in front of me in a few classes. So he would, if it was multiple choice, he'd give me the answers on his wrist and push his hand back behind his desk. So, it was really, really, I hate to say it, but I had really, at that point, no love of school, which sort of stripped away any moral compass. Like, I had no problem cheating, stealing homework or whatever from somebody else. So I did enough to get by, and my mother, who rest her soul, wanted me to go to college. But they really didn't know how to guide us, my sister and I being, guide either one of us. So my sister didn't go to college, nor did I. And they would say, go to school. My mother and father would say, go to college, please go to university. But they really, if my father said it, I said, why, Dad? Because I said so, because I'm your father. That's why. You respect your father.
No.
But it's not really, he didn't know, I felt bad because they weren't educated. So they really didn't know how to get us to sort of motivate us to go. But nonetheless, my mother said, please finish high school. My brother dropped out, and they were construction, my mother's family. And she said, that's all we've ever done was construction. I would love for you to, not have to work with your hands. So I told my mother I would finish high school. I did. Throughout high school, I was already running a chop shop. So I was already sort of like doing stuff where I was making money on the street. But I did graduate. I got a diploma. And then, I told my mother, I can't go to college. I just don't have it in me, Mom. And, at that point, I started hijacking trucks. And it was sad because my mother knew I was doing something wrong, didn't know exactly what it was. And her brother went to jail for hijacking. And she would say, I don't want you in jail. I visited my brother for how many years? I don't need this. And I'd say, Mom, I'm not going to jail. What are you talking about? I work for Ciro, not at the body shop. I would lie to my mother. Why was I out all day? I would say, I'm working for my buddy Ciro. So I always came up with something. But my mother knew deep down. She wasn't stupid.
Hey, Lou.
And,
If I can ask you really quickly, I don't know if the audience knows, what is hijacking trucks? I mean, what are you trying to do? Are you getting parts? What is it exactly you're trying to do there?
So the first time I hijacked a truck, it was I was running my chop shop. A chop shop is where we steal cars, and we have orders from auto body collision shops. They may give us like an order for, let's say, for example, you have an auto body collision shop, and you have four or five cars that you need parts for, and you're going to order the parts from GM or Chrysler or BMW or Mercedes, and you're going to pay maybe $1,000 for a bumper, $2,000 for leather seats or whatever from the parts department. You may give me the slip of paper with the cars that you need, and I'm getting to hijacking too to answer your question, but sure. This is how it started. So I would then have a list of the cars that you needed, and sometimes even specifically they would tell me the parts from those cars, so then I would just piece them out at my chop shop and then try to sell the rest to somebody else or dump the car. So I was selling the cars to different auto body collision shops in the area in Queens, and at some point or another I was in an auto body shop, and there was a big giant toolbox, and it was probably about probably shoulder height, reached my shoulders, about 5 foot high. So I said, "Wow, look at this!" And he goes, "Yeah, those are expensive. That box probably about $7,000-$8,000."
Oh.
I said, "Yes, you got to be kidding me." He said, "Yeah." He goes, "The truck comes once a week. He goes to deliver tools here, and the truck probably got over $100,000 of tools on it." So I said, "Wow." And if any of your listeners have ever seen them, they're those Snap-on trucks and Matco, they're very famous brand trucks. And so I said, "You want one?" He says, "What do you mean?" I go, "I'll take one." So he said, "Yeah, I'll take it, sure." So that was my first hijacking. I hijacked one of those trucks. And then I ended up hijacking a couple of them in the future after that. But from there, it led to – so I would take the contents of the truck, sell it, dump the truck. And from there, it led to just saying, gee, here's an easy way of making money. You know, I can make in one load, in 1 hour, what I was making in a week or a month with the chopping cars. So from then, you know, even if you're getting 10 cents or 15 cents or 20 cents on the dollar from a fence. So in the beginning, you know, I would steal truck that was stuff that was easy to sell, and we would sell it ourselves. And eventually I hooked up with a couple of different fences. But my main fence, who eventually ratted on me many, many years later, he was an older man, and you could go to him with anything. So let's say you're in the medical field as a doctor. Let's say you're an MD, for example. You say, gee, you know, I have these medical machines, the MRI machines. I don't know what to do with them, but I just, you know, I got a load of them. I have five of them in the back of a truck. You could go to this guy, and he'll go down a list, and he'll know the guy to contact for that. He'll say, okay, drop the machines off over here. The guy's going to take the serial numbers off and put new ones on, and he's going to sell them to this new doctor who just came in from outside the country who really doesn't know what's authentic and what's not. You know, and that's, you know, one scam leads to another, and basically anything I brought him, he unloaded. So I used him for years, my main fence, who was probably about 65 to 70 years old when he went sour. And I was just a kid at that point. I was 25 when I went to jail. So he was a lot older than me. And he had made those, he had established those connections throughout his lifetime. And how he maintained those connections on the street was his word was gold. Until he ratted on me and other people, he had never broken his word to anybody. And that's how he had sort of developed that network. And it's really a life lesson in business right there. You know, he could call anybody any time of night, and they'd give him $50,000 or $100,000 on the promise of bringing a load. You know, I mean, just like without even having the merchandise in their possession. So, you know, an incredibly powerful guy on the street he was to have in your corner. And that was sort of like part of why I was able to be successful. No matter what I brought him, he unloaded. I don't care if it was, you know, washing machines and dryers or audio cassette recorders back then. Your millennials might not know what that is. It came somewhere after 8-tracks and somewhere before CDs.
Oh, you're going too far back, Lou.
Yeah. But anything you brought him, I don't care if it was clothing, you know, we hijacked whatever it might have been. We brought it to him and he unloaded it. So that's sort of what hijacking was. So it started out with the tools, and eventually I continued that. I saw it was big money. It was easy money. And I put together a pretty good crew. We had a great crew of guys, great in the sense that we were able to accomplish what we wanted to do, you know, pretty seamlessly and smoothly without anybody getting hurt. You know, I look back, we could have easily got into you know, we were carrying loaded guns. We weren't trained to use them. We could have got into a shootout on the street. If somebody resisted us, something could happen. But I look back and, you know, I thank God now that I have a different life, that, you know, although I still regret that the fact that someone may have been traumatized, obviously, from a stick-up or a hijacking, but I at least thank God that nobody was physically injured, you know, because of it. So, you know, it's like, you know, I mean, look, I live with a lot of regret. That's a whole other part of my life, but...
let me ask you this.
Yeah.
It looks like this. That now your skill set caught the eye, or you were on the radar for the Gambino family. That's how I'm trying to keep a timeline here. That's kind of how you went over there.
Yeah. So eventually, if you're hijacking trucks, you know, just as if, like, for example, the mafia is a government within a government, right? That was said by Esther Scafalva back in the 50s, that he did an investigation into the mafia and said, they are a government within a government. So just imagine if you open up a business in, let's say, Southern Cal, and you want to sell surfboards, and you buy the ocean, and you're selling surfboards, you're doing great all year. At some point, the IRS is going to come knocking on your door and go, hey, you know what, this is great that you're selling surfboards and you're making a ton of money, but you owe the government a piece of this. So then you're going to say, oh, gee, but, you know, you owe the government money. So the mafia, if you're hijacking trucks, just imagine it as that's an underworld activity. So they're going to find out about you, just as the IRS would find out about you if you had a surf shop, and they're going to come looking for you. And they're going to say, hey, Lou, you know what? You're hijacking trucks. Who are you hijacking for? So at that point in your life, or, you know, in anyone's life, or in my life at that time, it wasn't a one-way street. It was a symbiotic relationship where you have the ability to go a lot farther with their backing, with the family's power behind you, and they get a piece of what you do. So it's not like it's a one-way street where they're shaking me down and go, we want a piece of every hijacked truck. The moment you sign out with them, you're a powerful guy. You can pretty much do anything you want on the street because you have the mob behind you, and you also get tips from them. I can't begin to tell you how much more money I made once I had all of the guys on the street working through the mafia network giving me tips on trucks.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, a guy might come to me on a Tuesday and say, you know, my brother-in-law routes trucks for this company, and he's got this tractor trailer going out of Newark Airport tomorrow and coming down to JFK, and you're going to have an hour to get him, you know, or it's going to be a give-up. You know, Louis, great, you know, you got a guy for, you know, can you take the trailer? You got somebody to take the merchandise, and I would go to my fence if it was a give up, which meant that the driver was in on it. So I made a lot more money once I was in the mob. So it sort of like works both ways, but that's how it works. That's how you come to their attention.
Fascinating stuff. Yeah, I guess I can imagine so. You have their power, you have their resources, everything would bump you up. Let me ask you this question. I'm going to bring you back to psychology for a minute. What do you think motivated the individual, the contact person you had who said that eventually ratted you out around 65 or 70? Do you think he was caught and you were putting the pressure on him? Obviously, he probably didn't want to go to jail at that age.
I have a strong idea of what happened. So the best information we have, because he was a confidential informant and then led the FBI in a lot of directions, one being me. So he never openly testified in court. So we don't have concrete evidence as to what the history was behind his arrest, but from the streets, what we gathered, because we did know his son, who gave us a lot of information, from what, you know, the son was in contact with him while it happened, and then the son was trying to sneak us information on the side, and from what I understood is he had come to us about a year before he got in trouble, and he came to me and his nephew, who had introduced me to him, and we were making a lot of money with him. And he asked us if we wanted something called China White, which was a heroin. And we had it was forbidden to sell drugs in the mafia, in the Gambino family. Now, that's not to say they didn't do it. That's to say that the general rule was that you weren't allowed to, and if you did break that rule, you ended up in a trunk. But they also had people that, I know this guy a long time, and they'd give the guy a wink. You know, it depends who it was, who had the authority, who had the permission, who they decided to look the other way on, like any corrupt government, right?
Sure.
I mean, obviously. So the at that point, we turned it down. We didn't want to get involved. I knew there was a couple of reasons why I didn't want to go near heroin. One was I never dealt drugs, and I had a junkie in my family, an addict, I should say. I don't know if junkie is now ruled as an impolitically correct term, but it should be, because it's sad. People have, you know, it's very sad when they have sort of like that you know, chemical addiction. But he was an addict, and he caused my family a lot of heartache, and I loved him. And I didn't want to go anywhere near drugs and cause that curse on any other family, ever. So I never wanted to sell drugs. So it was something, you know, morally that I didn't, how could I say morally? I'm sticking up trucks, but in my mind, the twisted, broken moral compass that I had at that time, drugs was forbidden in my mind. I didn't want to sell them. Then on top of that, you had the edict from the family, because you could always sell drugs. You would just have to go to the family and say, I want to break away. I'm going to sell drugs. And then your capo releases you. I mean, that happened through friends of mine.
Oh, wow.
They couldn't resist the law. So one of my friends had a, he was at a Canarsie, canoe and Canarsie crew we belonged to in Canarsie, Brooklyn. And he went to his skipper or capo, and he said, look, you know, I have an opportunity to make like $40,000 a kilo. I don't make that all year with you guys. You know, and they said, look, you can't come around the club anymore. You can't have anything to do with us. Lose all of our phone numbers and good luck. You know, and you know, when you're done, if you want to come around again, you're welcome. But until then, you know, we don't want anything to do with you. So you could leave them, but so the mafia edict was secondary. Most of it for me was, I don't want to deal drugs. I don't want to create addicts and put families through what my family went through, because I was a little kid in pajamas watching my mother pace the floors and my father biting his nails, and I didn't want to have that again. So, you know, my grandmother, you know, so
it's a horrible thing.
Horrible thing. So, and, you know, now we have an epidemic in this country, which is very sad. You know, I think we could do more about it. We're not. I wish we were. That was another reason. And then the last thing were the sentences were stiff. So I passed on it. So to bring back around to you, bring us back around to your original question was, what happened to him? We gathered that after we turned it down, the China White was apparently coming into the country, and he had access to it, which we don't know why he did it himself, other than the temptation of making. We understood it to be making like $100,000 a kilo. So
wow.
Cocaine was a lot less than heroin at the time, as I understood it. So he had the opportunity to make $100,000 a kilo. I mean, you move 10 kilos a month, you got $1 million in cash a month. And I gathered, couldn't resist that temptation. So for us, the trucks were enough. The merchandise was enough. Who were we hurting? And in my mind at that time, you know, we always told the driver, we're not after you. You'll be home by 5 o'clock with your wife eating dinner. Just let us have the truck, you know, and as far as we were concerned, it was insured. You know, these are big companies. They just put in a claim. So we didn't see it as really hurting personal families.
Sure.
And, again, it was a twisted moral code that I had, because obviously it's not a victimless crime. There are, you know, obviously it's still a crime. But in my mind, it was at that time, it was victimless, I thought. You know, I didn't really go deep into who could we really be hurting by doing? Yeah, obviously, if I thought that deep, I would have figured it out, but.
It's an interesting point, because people do, it is so distant from the actual victim. You're not really hurting the driver, you're not really hurting directly the company, you're going all the way to the insurance company, which a lot of times they demonize nowadays as well.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
We didn't see it. Yeah, we didn't see it as evil. I mean, just, you know, shame on me now, but back then I didn't see it as evil.
Let me ask you this. I'm not even sure if you can answer this question or not. But so, folks, there's some things we can't get, but we'll try. Let me ask you this, Lou. You mentioned drug sales. You mentioned the mafia. How different and what? Actually, let me phrase it this way. What did the mafia think of or does think of the drug cartels? And are they similar in operation, do you think?
I did 8.5 years in the feds, so obviously I bumped into a lot of guys who were really big wheels within the cartels. The way we viewed them is it's a lot different now. I mean, the mafia has experienced a level of degeneracy and decline that's, you know, it's almost unspeakable. I could get into it with you, but it would be an hour long show within itself. But to sort of just gloss over that part. When I was on the street, at least, and the code was still sort of more firm in certain ways, we thought of the cartels as sort of like immoral in the sense that if you crossed the cartels and they killed your whole family and, you know, to your last born son, we thought that that was extreme. You know, we had these rules where you were supposed to, the family is off limits. You're not even supposed to. The way I was raised in that life by the old timers that brought me around, you know, that I eventually ended up being schooled by. And I sat at the feet of, you know, monumental, legendary mobsters at one point or another, you know, listening to the lessons of how this life is supposed to be. As I understood it, if a guy owed me money, let's say, for example, a guy owed me $100,000, for argument's sake, and I knew where he lived, I wasn't even allowed to go knock on his door, because how dare you go to his house knowing his mother is there, or his wife, or his daughter, or what have you. Yeah, the house is sacred. Now, that's not to say I can't catch him a block away and run him over with my car, put him in the hospital, or murder him. I mean, you know, this is why the code is twisted, but you're not allowed to do it in front of his family. Now, just as I was, before I went to prison, that was starting to change. I knew somebody who was shot in front of his house. I knew someone else, Gaspipe Casso, who was the Lucchese family underboss at one time. He had ordered someone's sister shot, which was disgusting to us. The rest of us were appalled at that at the time. We couldn't believe that people were breaking rules like that. So the mafia did have at least some point, but people started to break those rules. But we did have some sense of family was too sacred and too off limits to mess with. You just don't do that. If you have a problem with Dr. Carlos, take it up with Dr. Carlos. But if you see Dr. Carlos at the ice cream stand with his children, you better drive away. Because don't even confront him there, because it's not fair to his children. Or if you see Dr. Carlos at a restaurant with his wife, you know, how dare you interfere with his dinner? And I would have gotten in trouble for that, even if you were the aggressor.
What would happen to you?
Well, believe it or not, you know, if you're under the right captain, he could put you on a shelf. You know, he could tell you that was disgusting. You could end up in a sit-down where, I'll give you an example. So a friend of mine became a made man eventually. Before he was a made man, we were kids at the time, we were young teens, and his sister was beaten up in a park, and one of the girls broke a bottle and cut her. So when she came home bleeding and asked him to be taken to the hospital, he told his mother, take her to the hospital, I'm going to the park. So he went to the park and tracked down the girls, and he beat their brains in. Now, that's not to say he's right or wrong beating up girls, but he said, to hell with it, they caught my sister. So he beat the girls' brains in. He said, if they're butchers, you know, Butch, B-U-T-C-H, if they're butchers, which was sort of like this derogatory name at that time for a tough girl, he said, then I can beat them up like men if they want to act like men. So he beat them up, and he went home and went back out. And later on that night, one of the girls' fathers was a legitimate wise guy. A killer. He went to his house demanding, he wanted to kill him, and he's banging on the door. The mother came to the door, and the mother's fighting him at the door. So at the end of the sit down, they basically ruled that he wanted him dead for raising his hands to his daughters. And it wasn't enough to beat the case that his sister was cut, because the wise guy's argument was, if my daughter cut your daughter, you take it to a sit-down. You go to your uncle, who's a legitimate guy who can talk to me, and we can handle it at the table. But you have no right beating up my daughter. So he lost on that issue. Why it got squashed was the wise guy went to his house. And once the wise guy went to his house and stepped foot on his porch, then he had committed more of a wrong than my friend by beating up the two girls in the park. The daughter. One was a daughter.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like technical... You know, it's like really gets like...
It does.
Like, yeah, I mean, you got to pull out the law books or the Talmud at some point, right? you see how this goes, though. So could I get in trouble for approaching Dr. Carlos, let's say, at a restaurant while he's eating dinner with his wife? Probably if you went to somebody you knew and said, look, I owe him money. I'm not saying I don't. But how dare him come up to me in a restaurant while I'm sitting with my wife? You know, so at that point, I could be in trouble.
That's really amazing, because like you said, you don't have a, you almost like you need a rule book just to be able. Did you guys have a book by chance?
No, I mean, these are the things you learn. Some of them you learn by error. You know, you make a mistake, and you know, it's sad because some people make mistakes that cost them their lives, and it's very sad. You know, so in the, it's almost like, you know, you teach your son or your nephew to drive, and you hope that, you know, if he has a speeding accident, he had his seatbelt on, he gets out of it, and he learns a lesson not to speed. And there are some parents who are unfortunate and lose their son the first speeding accident, which is very sad. So it's the same in the mob. If you make a mistake, sometimes it costs people their lives. Hopefully you make errors that you live and learn from. And, you know, so you live as you go, but you also live from learning from people, which I did by the old timers who taught me. There's always stories. It's almost like the Homeric age where people will, you know, it's the oral teaching, you know, where you have, like, lessons you learn. Let me tell you, Louis, about this guy. Back then, Vino had a beef with Gino, and then Nino came along, and this is what happened. You know, and they tell you the whole story about how, you know, how it unraveled, and you might learn something from it. You know, like, basically, like anybody else, you're in your apprenticeship, and you pick things up. But, you know, again, the life lessons that are real, that might hurt, you hope you don't make those that cost you your life, but I have seen people make, you know, major errors that did cost them their lives, and you just hope that don't happen. You know, I mean, that's life, though, right?
This may be an unusual question. Maybe you've been asked before. I don't know. Do you miss some of the individuals that you were part of in that family?
I don't miss the life, but some of the people that I met, I'm close with a couple of guys who also retired. You know, they're done.
This is a strong bond. It's a really strong bond that you're talking about.
Yeah. So, I mean, they left the life. They did time. One of my friends was with the Casey family. He did 10 years and left the life. Another one of my friends was with the Colombo family. He did, I think, just under 10. He left the life. And they're authentic. They genuinely left the life. They're done. They have nothing to do with it. So I'm able to still sort of, like, connect with them because we understand each other. You know, we might go for dinner and reminisce and have a lot of laughs about the old days. But I don't miss that life. But some of the characters, obviously, I met some of the greatest guys in my life in that world. You know, who were funny, who were genuine, who were, you know, honorable in the sense that they had your back. You know, not that we were doing honorable things. You know, we weren't models of civic virtue, but we were honorable and trusting of each other. So, you know, that's hard to find nowadays. You know, the business world is so cutthroat. You know, people tell me, you know, I introduce maybe two businessmen and I tell them, look, you know, put me in the deal. And next thing you know, you're off the email. You never get another phone call. You know, they're off to the races. But back then, if you introduced two guys and you said, put me in the deal, you were in the deal. You know, they came to you and said, look, Lou, we made $10,000. Here's $1,000. You know, we just want to, you know, tip you a thank you. Appreciate it. Anytime we do it again, you know, you're in. You know, you don't get that nowadays. I don't find that in the real world. You know, it could be out there, but, you know, I've met a couple of people who are really honorable. There are a few, but I'm saying on the whole, no.
Kind of reminds me of the Wild West when the man's word meant something.
Yeah, you have only your word. You know, that's what you had. And I did like that. I liked that aspect of it, where you had your word. It was like a traveling resume, and it went with you everywhere. You know, anybody, anywhere I went, people vouched for me. You know, I could have went somewhere and said, well, I want to borrow $1 million from any wise guy on the street. They would have gave it to me because they knew that, you know, I was good for it, you know, or whatever I did with anybody. So, that, you know, that was nice. You know, it's... Go now and ask for $1 million. You got to put your house up, you know, your firstborn son. You know, how much jewelry do you have? You know, I mean, this is like, but you know, it's different. So there were aspects of the life that I missed, but I don't. You know, not aspects of the life, traits of the people, and some of the people I missed, but not the life itself, not at all. I don't want to ever commit another crime again as long as I live, so I don't miss that at all.
And folks, we have a couple minutes left. I got two more questions for you, Lou. Love to bring you back too. I mean, we'd love to continue that conversation, especially about how the mob has changed and how they've changed. But before we're not going to get to that today. But hopefully, another day we can bring you back. But I want to ask you two more questions. One is the irony. You mentioned you hated school, you thought it was like prison, and then when you're in prison, you decide to do what you do in school, which is read. How did that happen?
I never knew. So my issue with school is probably I didn't like being I guess, you know, the whole control, you know, go from this class to that class. This is what you're gonna read. This is what you're gonna study. This is what you need to know. I have an instinctual, intuitive sort of rebellion against that sort of. You know, they're trying to. I'm the same as every other student. I guess I didn't like that. So I was never really inspired to learn. Once I was in prison and had nothing to do but, you know, stare at the wall, play cards, or read, I picked up my first book. I was literate. Obviously, I graduated high school. I knew how to read. But I had never read a book cover to cover before in my life. So I couldn't tell you what one was. If I did a book report, I cheated. You know, even people go to Ivy League colleges and graduate from Ivy League colleges and will tell you I never read a book cover to cover. You know, there's Cliff Notes.
That's
there's
true.
Other ways to do a book reports. So I never read a book cover to cover. So once I picked one up, I fell in love with reading. And by the grace of God, I sat in a prison cell and said, wow, what a blessing. I can't believe it. I would have never known. And, you know, my first books were very hard. My vocabulary was horrible. I bought a dictionary for a couple of stamps, maybe, and it was missing X, Y, and Z. It had no covers, but I used it to look up words I didn't know. I would write down the definitions. I would study the words. I was doing this all in a prison cell. And then one book led to another, and then maybe the first books took me, you know, weeks to read, then the next one a week, and then the next one 3 days, and then eventually I was reading a book a day.
I would begin
a book in the morning, 300-page book, start in the morning, done at night. If it's 1,000 pages, it took me maybe 2 or 3 days. But I would just be 18 hours a day. I read until I fell asleep with the book on my chest, and I fell in love with reading. I'm an avid reader till today. I've been home for years, and I still read constantly. At night, I don't turn on the TV. You know, very rarely do I flip the TV on. Usually I'm in bed with a book. So that's what I enjoy. I would have never found that love of books. And that, I taught myself how to become a writer. I've been fortunate. My last book, I went to a team meeting before you leave prison, and they asked you, what are you going to do with your life when I get out? I said, I'm going to be an author. They were hysterical. And as I speak to you today, my last book, Mob Rules, is in 20 languages. It's an international bestseller. It keeps selling more and more each year. And I'm writing another book. And I've written 3 books. I also wrote a book about the brain, a little theory I had about the dreaming brain.
Interesting.
Which is like... Yeah, it's got a niche audience. It's not like really, it's not a bestseller or anything like my other book. But, you know, it's a niche audience. You have to be interested in that subject and want to pick it up. And then I get into physics and psychology and neuroscience, and it's interesting.
It's kind of funny because when you read so much, you want to be able to share that knowledge after reading all that. Because I think we have kindred spirits. I don't watch TV either. I read usually every night. Fascinating.
There you go.
Folks, by the way, some of the books right here you can get on Amazon is Unlocked, The Life and Crimes of a Mafia Insider, and the one he just mentioned was Mob Rules, What the Mafia Can Teach the Legitimate Businessman. Last question for you, Lou. What do you, if you had a message to get out to people in regards to dispelling myths about the mob, which one would be one that you say, you know what, that's not even close to being accurate? I know there's movies out there like The Godfather, Scarface, Analyze This, which is another one. Anything out there you say, you know what, this is so far from reality?
Some of them are ridiculous. I think that they all have, some of them are realistic in a sense, but I think they all have this sort of like, you walk away with it, even if it's just partially and not wholly a romantic vision of the mob. And I think that that's the biggest fallacy ever. There's nothing romantic about it. You know, it's nice to have power, it's nice to have money, it's nice to have as many women as you want when you're a young man, but you know what, in the end it's a dead end. And I learned that when I went to prison, and I also have seen plenty of people die, get killed. So you know, when you're in jail, I was charged with eventually 3 violent felonies. I faced the rest of my life in prison. I was in the worst prisons. I was in Lewisburg Penitentiary. My first day in population, there was a double homicide. So these places are off the charts. You know, they were just getting hacked to death with machetes. And they have machetes in the penitentiary, by the way. So, you know, there's nothing romantic about prison either. This is like... The reality of it, which I lived, is a harsh, hard world. And for people, you know, you see John Gotti with his, you know, thousands of dollars he pays for a suit, and he looks like $1 million, and he's got the, you know, the coiffed hair, and the barber does him every day, and he looks like, it's an illusion. You know, John Gotti ended up dying in a prison cell, wishing he was home with his family. So there's nothing really exciting or romantic about it at the end of the day. Exciting in the sense that, yeah, sure, hijacking the truck is exciting. It's a lot more exciting than driving up the store for milk, which is what I do now. You know, but exciting as far as like a sort of, that excitement isn't sustained in the way that I'd rather live an uneventful life where, you know, whatever you do, you have a clear head, you have a clear conscience, and the excitement that you get out of life is, you know, your own, you know, go parasailing, go on vacation with your family. That's real excitement. Memories, build memories that could be taken with you until the day you die. I think that's a lot better and nicer. So the mobs, it's a big illusion. Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for the kids that fall for it today. It's a dead end.
That's a great message. By the way, you did get a chance to go visit some of the toughest prisons in the world. It's a little bit more than going grab your milk. But
yeah, oh yeah, I shouldn't say that. You're right. I mean, that was the first show. Yeah, I was locked in El Salvador and Philippines. I did. I went to some of the worst prisons in the world and locked in with the inmates. That show for Discovery did phenomenal. It rated great throughout the world too. It's sad because I'm going to tell you what Discovery did. It had millions and millions of hits on YouTube.
Yeah.
Each video had 10, 15 million hits. And I brought it to Discovery's attention, telling them, you know, maybe we should do another round of this. And the new administration of Discovery wasn't into it because someone else had commissioned the show, who's gone now. And not only that, but they took down some of the biggest videos that were hit, Discovery did. So that was kind of like...
Oh, no.
Yeah, you know, I was bringing it to their attention, saying this could translate into ratings and viewers, and, you know, they not only passed, but then had, I guess, their legal department contact the YouTube channels and take them down. There's still quite a few floating around out there for your viewers. It's called Inside the Gangster's Code. I'd like to produce and host another show at some point. It just has to be the right one. I'd like to bring sort of like some type of journalistic value to a show. I don't want to do, like, you know, I've been approached with such ridiculous ideas. And, you know, yeah, I mean, they want to, you know, caricature you. Hey, oh, Papa, what are you doing? I don't want to do those shows. I want to do something that, you know, has some type of value that you could be proud of when you walk away from it. And Gangster Code had that, Inside the Gangster's Code. I thought, you know, we gave people an inside view, the viewers, an inside sort of, like, look at that subculture of prison.
It was fascinating.
Yeah.
Didn't you go to Italy or no? Did you go to Italy too, right?
Yeah, we did Italy too. We did the Camorra. I'll tell you a funny thing that happened.
That was your original place with a mobster. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. Italy was great. I walked into the prison in Naples, and I got lucky there. They were really, in Italy, they were real, like, they were looking at me cross-eyed. Who is this guy? He's going to film us? And the head of the mafia... He was head of the Sicilian Mafia, who was doing time in Naples. They shipped the Sicilians to Naples, and the Napolitans, they shipped to Sicily, so that they're away from, you know, their main base. And the head of the Mafia, who was in that prison, the highest ranking guy for the Sicilian Mafia, and then Drangheta, too, was there, too. But the head of the Sicilian Mafia came up to me, and he said, he asked me if I knew a guy. I can't say, I think he died now, but his family's still around, so I'm not going to say his name. But he asked me if I knew him, and the guy was... He was older at the time. So I said, yeah, I know him. You get in touch with him, and you ask him if I'm all right, and because I knew the guy really well. And he did. And when I came back to film a day or two later, he said, the whole prison is yours. Do whatever you want. He goes, we got word to him. He sent back word. Anything you want is yours. So that was nice. So it still carried weight, even though I left the mob years ago. I left with a good name, you know, so that I didn't rat on anybody. And I left with an honorable name, and he was still willing to send word back to Naples that, you know, what that out. Louis is a good guy. If he tells you that, you know, whatever he tells you, you can take him at his word, which was good.
You know, we should do a show just on that topic alone about the importance of giving your word. That would be a fascinating, fascinating topic. Yeah. Hey, again, it's no everything. Dishonorable discharge for you. What?
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Doctor. It's everything. It's so powerful.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredible how today we just don't have that. Everybody, Lou Ferrante, you can find him on his website, Louis, L-O-U-I-S, Ferrante, F-E-R-R-A-N-T-E. Lou, anywhere you want to send people as we wrap up the show?
No, that's fine. I'm not big on social media, so, the, you know, website's cool. You can always drop me an email. You know, I mean, and I'd be happy to come out. Working on a history of the mafia right now. I'll be done in about a year. Well, maybe we'll talk about that, too, at some point.
Oh, that'd be good, too. That'd be really good. Yeah. It's interesting because I did have a conversation with a gentleman 2 years ago on the Jewish mafia.
I included them. The Jews were a big part of the Italian mafia, too.
Yeah, that surprised me.
I think Jewish and Italian families are so alike. You know, aside from, you know, the religions, obviously, are very different. But the family structure and the importance of family, and, you know, especially like, you know, now, I hate to say it, but the country... The country's probably a lot different. Like when I was a kid, my father had 7 brothers and sisters, all the cousins. We used to pack into one house and eat all our dinners and stuff. And, you know, nowadays we don't, I don't think, have the Spanish are the same way too, by the way, but I don't think we have the same importance on families. The Italian immigrant wave came here and collided with the Jewish immigrant wave. A lot of Jews from Eastern Europe were coming to the country at the same time, and they found a lot in common. Both of them were prejudiced against the Jews and the Italians, and they were kind of shoved into the same ghettos. And, you know, the Jew and the Italian looked at each other and says, look, you know what? I'll provide the muscle. You provide some ideas and brains, and let's pull this off. You know, and that's basically how it worked. A lot of, you know, not to take away from the Italian brains at the time, because they did have them, but the Jews were the idea men. And a lot of them came up with, like, tremendous, like, rackets that the Italians eventually inherited as the Jews sort of slowly walked away from that world.
I'll tell you, I don't want to hang up, but I have to. But it's amazing we can be here for hours. Absolutely. Folks, remember, you can follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, YouTube. We're just about everywhere. You can also subscribe on iHeartRadio as well as iTunes. Once again, folks, this is Circle of Insight. Wherever there's psychology involved, we're going to be there.